We will first go into a public hearing and a possible work session on Senate Bill 975. I understand we have Sarah Kastner from the Department of Justice and Brian DeLashman from the OCPA here. And Rich Peppers, is he here? All right. He's on board with this team, too. Mr. DeLashman, would you please tell us where we are with this bill?
I think we're finally in a good place. For the record, Brian DeLashman, Oregon Council of Police Associations. This has been one of those that's kind of morphed several times over the last week or so. It deals with public records, specifically to law enforcement. There's two basic elements into it. One is if you're an undercover, designated as an undercover officer, what in fact can be released without having to go through the court and the in-camera situation. The other piece is if you're not undercover, you're law enforcement. In fact, what portion of public records in your personnel file can be released. We now have agreement with the Department of Justice, who Sarah's here and can answer any questions about their concerns or original concerns, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the state police, the counties, and everyone else in the world who has come forward at the last minute. This bill passed the Senate, I believe, unanimously.
This bill was sponsored by Senator Tony Corcoran. I assume that you have his blessing to proceed with the modifications that you presented here.
Yeah.
All right. I was only kidding when I said Tony the Cork. He's an old friend of mine. I can get away with that.
As he is a friend of mine. The one problem that did arise at a very late hour yesterday, actually between 5 and 5:30, was an oversight. So if you look at the A3 amendments, the problem that arose was that the way it was drafted, if in fact a undercover officer requested information to be released, for example, on a loan, on an auto loan or something like that, the agency couldn't release that. So the corrections that I've drafted basically takes care of that situation. It's inserted in line 14.
And the problem is the A5s were... Mr. Peppers, good morning. Come on up. the A5s, unfortunately, did not reflect the proper revisions. So what I understand from our earlier conversations is if you take the A3,
correct,
and then on page 2 of the A3 on line 22, you deleted the phrase requested by and only to the extent, and then... In section 2.2, which I'm looking back here, is on page 1,
line 14,
after the word disclosure, which is lines 13 and 14, and before the word... Before the comma here. Requires,
yeah,
disclosure or the employee consents in writing to disclosure. So those are the two changes that were necessary. Now, so from your perspective and your client's perspective... Mr. DeLashman, with these changes, this bill does what everybody wants it to do.
It does, and appears not to cause any difficulties to any of the agencies that had some questions about it.
Let me pause for a moment. I'll be talking to you, Ms. Kastner and Mr. Peppers, in a moment. Is there anybody in the room that has anything to say about 975 that didn't sign up, because I've only got DeLashman, Kastner, and Peppers signed up? All right. So nobody's breaking down the doors to object to this. Mr. Peppers, I'll jump to you because Ms. Kastner is really here in more of a neutral perspective. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. Turn off your phone and tell us what you think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union, and I apologize for walking in late. I was stuck in traffic. Thanks for entertaining this amendment I have. If you could help me out with the number of my amendments, I, as you know, just came in from being late, but I am seeking an amendment of just three small words in line 31 of page 2 of the bill that would insert in line 31 the item dates of birth as one of the items that would not be released to the public. And the issue is simply that this item serves as an individual identifier for employees when issues of personal nature would be normally withheld this is something that we would like to also withhold so that database searches would not be possible to individually identify people in credit card records or any other kinds of personal comparisons.
All right, now let me hear from Sarah Kastner.
Good morning. I'm Sarah Kastner with Department of Justice. Chair Mannix, I was just told about these recent amendments. Now, this is to the public records law itself, to the exemption from telephone and addresses of public employees.
That's correct.
And I don't have a position on that and don't know that the department has a position because we haven't considered it at this point.
Why don't you address the rest of these amendments first, since that's really why you came up.
Okay. Chair Mannix and members of the committee, the reason that we got involved with this was that the original bill was much broader than I believe Mr. DeLashmet and the sponsors of the bill intended. And the as it was originally drafted, it prevented any public body from giving out information on any undercover officer or any police officer or corrections officer that they had information about. And that was of concern to us, primarily the agency that I represent as DMV. They were concerned because it would prevent them from giving out any licensing information or driving record information on anyone who was an undercover officer or a police officer or corrections officer, even if they were legitimately stopped in their own personal car for a traffic violation or something. So DMV contacted me and asked me to look at the bill, and I in turn contacted Mr. DeLashmet. And based on my understanding of the purpose of this bill, which is really for the employer to protect the information that they have concerning their employees who are public safety employees or undercover officers, we drafted the proposed amendments, which are the Senate Bill 975-A3 amendments, to clarify who it applied to and who it was intended to cover, which is the public safety employee employer and the undercover officer employer. And we've worked with Oregon State Police, with the Oregon Association of Counties, in coming up with what we think everyone can live with.
Now let me ask Mr. DeLashmet, have you had any conversations with Mr. Peppers about this this additional change?
For the record, again, Brian DeLashmet. Yes, I have. I have absolutely no objections to the Peppers Amendment. Obviously, to be real frank with you, I said as long as it doesn't hurt the bill, I've got no problem with it. In fact, I think it's probably a good addition.
Mr. Peppers, have you had a chance to run this by some of the, for instance, DOS or the state police, or obviously the Department of Justice hasn't seen it before?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I haven't run it by the Department of Justice, but I have run it by DOS. And,
that's the Department of Administrative Services, for those listening in on the Internet. I'm the one who said DOS first. I should have said it before. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and they had no objections. I spoke with Mr. Kennedy.
Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, at this point, we've talked about the A2, which is the Peppers Amendment, and the A3. I've got an A5 that just came out today.
And apparently that was a flawed revision of the A3.
Yeah,
I got word
that A5 is no longer to be considered.
Longer. Yeah, it was supposed to be the A3 with the corrections, and it came out incorrect itself. So
this is a, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes.
The paper that Brian gave us this morning is a correction to the A3 amendments that we currently have.
Correct, and with the addition of the comment that the Chair made, if you look at the A3 on page 2, line 22, the A5 was supposed to delete part of the first sentence under C. It should have deleted requested by and only to the extent. So that sentence would read, when disclosure is necessary for the investigation. That was the other change that the A5 was supposed to have accomplished and did not.
I'm sorry, what line was that? What
line page? 22 on page 2 of the A3. So it's the sub C there.
Uh-huh.
You should be deleting requested by and only to the extent.
Okay.
Again, that was the drafting error that was supposed to be corrected by -5 and was not.
And you've handed out a letter to us showing the other correction that you wanted to see to the A3.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chair, you ready for a motion?
Well, we need to want to clarify something else. For some reason, I don't have my A2s in front of me. Does council have his? All right. So those are in proper form. I understand the Department of Justice can't comment on those because you haven't seen those before. Just to make sure we're clear here, and then what we'll do first is we'll close the public hearing and move into work session. As I understand it, with the bill in front of us and all parties on board, with the Department of Justice giving us a caveat about this date of birth language, it is considered by those involved in this process, the proponents here, that it's all right to adopt the A2 amendments, and then we'll talk about the A3 amendments in a moment, but first I'd entertain a motion that we adopt the A2 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Justin Bowman moves adoption of the A2 amendments. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the A2 amendments are adopted. We now have the A3 amendments in front of us. I'd request a motion from Representative Bowman that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment to the A3 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Is there any objection to the motion? By unanimous consent, the rules are suspended to allow the, there being no objection, to allow the adoption of a conceptual amendment to the A3 amendments. As I understand the conceptual amendment, on page 1 of the A3 amendments, on line 14, it's actually from lines 13 to 14. After the word disclosure, we would insert the phrase, or the employee consents in writing to disclosure, comma, and then you pick up with the rest of the amendments. Then on page 2 of the A3 amendments, on line 22, you would eliminate the phrase, requested by and only to the extent. That phrase would be removed. Representative Bowman, do you move that conceptual amendment to the A3 amendments?
I do, Mr. Chair.
All right. In fact, if it's appropriate, I would entertain a motion that we adopt the A3 amendments with that conceptual change. Are you willing to make that motion?
So moved.
All right. Colleagues, you've heard that Representative Bowman has moved that we adopt the A3 amendments with the conceptual changes that I've already described. Is there discussion on that? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the A3 amendments as modified conceptually are adopted. President Bowman, do you move the bill?
I move Senate Bill 975 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard that motion. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 975 is sent to the floor with a due pass. Volunteer for a carrier? President Bowman will carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee, for your indulgence.
You're welcome.
Against Odyssey.
This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 975. The Odyssey of 975. It's a nice way of describing it. Next up, we're going back to House Bill 2605. Council, would you tell us where we are with this?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. As the committee will recall, this bill originally imposed mandatory life imprisonment for a third or later conviction for some sex offenses. We brought it back approximately a week ago because the wrong bill got engrossed. And then what we need to do today is we need to actually adopt the A10 amendments. What happened before is that the amendments which were adopted a week ago were amendments to the original bill, not the engrossed bill. Legislative Council contacted me and requested that we instead adopt the A10 amendments to comply with what the committee originally intended to do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess I do want to put on the record, I look at the A10s and just make sure we don't have another problem. It really seems to mirror the minority report that was filed, and if the intent of the chair is to address or take the minority report and make it the committee report, that's fine with me. But it does seem, when I look at the A10s, actually makes the minority report the committee report.
Mr. Horton, could you explain the A10s?
I'll take another look at that, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe it does. The reason being that, as I recall, the difference between what the committee intended the committee report to do and the minority report would have been simply the operative date. And because the A engrossed bill is what the committee is looking at right now, and the A engrossed bill, I believe, does have that operative date in it, if the A10 amendments were adopted, the operative date would stay in what would become the B engrossed bill, and I believe that was the difference. Is that correct, Representative Posnansky?
I thought maybe that was a mistake that brought it all back. I did not realize that the committee had actually narrowed the charges down to the 5. I thought that the committee was maintaining additional charges than the five that were in the minority report.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, that is what the A. Engrost bill mistakenly did. What the committee intended to do was to narrow the charges down and make that upon the second offense rather than the third offense.
Right.
Okay.
So let's be clear on the versions we have in front of us. We're looking at the A. Engrost bill, 2605. It says page one of the printed Engrost bill. I want to make sure it's the one that was ordered by the House May 19, including House amendments to May 19. That has the longer list.
Correct.
All right.
They need to have an operative modify that. The agent does what counsel just said.
2001.
Right. But I guess I did not realize when we had the bill before us weeks ago that we had at the committee narrowed it down that far.
To what's on the Engrost?
Well, actually wouldn't be reflected in the minority report, just the five basically first degree offenses with the one that's I guess the only one that's not a first degree is using a child.
I'm sorry, I'm just checking with Mr. Horton.
The bottom line is, if when you look at the minority report, if you put the operative date of 2001, then that would be what the A-10 accomplishes with the Engrost.
Well, the other difference is, the minority report did say second or subsequent conviction, and there's been treatment.
Right. Yeah, it was the committee report that got soft on time and said third conviction.
But again, Mr. Chairman, that was a mistake.
Printed that.
A printed mistake.
But as I'm reading what we have in front of us now, the A-10 amendments, talk about third or subsequent. We change that to second.
Right.
Line 6 after section, if the person doesn't, we talk about treatment on line 6 because that was supposed to be there. If the person is a result of the prior conviction. Line 12, putting in applies. Okay, so we are shortening the list again.
Right.
All right.
Basically, you're going to have on the A. Engrost lines 13, 16, 19, 21, and 23 stay intact. All the others come out.
That's right. And we have an operative date of July 1. So actually, that does get us back down. But that might have been a misunderstanding when we first acted on it. You might have thought we were leaving it as the long list. And that might resolve concerns of the minority report, because the only difference would end up being the operative date.
Possibly, Mr. Chair. Another
unlikely, but...
Another thing that you may want to consider, which I think is important.
So let's do this. First of all, I don't know if I banged this into work session, but in case I did, we are in work session on House Bill 2605. I'd first entertain a motion that we reconsider the action which we sent out, House Bill 2605. So we'll have it in front of us. President Simmons, some moves. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there objection to that motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried, and House Bill 2605 is in front of us for reconsideration. Representative Przanski, you have a suggestion?
I do. Regarding, I think another change that we should consider in this committee is whether or not we want to maintain these individuals in prison until they die. Based on what the majority report would have, it would be a life sentence with no possibility of ever being out. And for anyone that's been to the prisons, you'll see that we are quickly reaching a point of where we're going to have a geriatric prison. It's a given. And the cost of maintaining those individuals may outweigh the public safety concerns. I've spoken with the Sex Offender Supervision Network and asked them for comments, and I guess what I would be proposing for this committee to consider is whether or not we want to have like a minimum mandatory 30 years in prison, and at that point in time they would be able to ask for release, and there'd be four elements of criteria that would have to be met before they could be released, and those would include a favorable psych sexual evaluation was ordered by and received by the board. A favorable housing plan was submitted that established a secured residence, not simply some type of subsidy housing. and this brought out through the network that this is very important, especially with elderly offenders, because of the difficulty of getting them placed in a community because of their medical needs. Third, we participation in and successful completion of the available sex offender treatment program while in prison. We all understand at this point there's not really much happening in that area, but if there was the opportunity, they would have to be able to make that claim and demonstrate that they actually did participate and were successful in their participation while they're in prison. And then lastly, retaining the ability for the Board of Parole to be able to revoke these offenders back to DOC based on some type of violation and for the remaining portion of their sentence. And this would be very similar to what we have in the codified statute that's already there. And if the chair is willing to think about that or whatever, I'll be glad to hand out copies of this letter I have. If not, I will just tell the committee I will be bringing that out as a minor report.
Let's talk about this for a minute. Another alternative might be to talk about adding some phraseology to the extent except that the person may be released to a health care facility or a long-term care facility when the person is of such advanced age or of such debilitated medical condition that the person does not constitute a significant threat to public safety.
Mr. Chair, if we were going to have some dialogue, I guess the only thing is if you're going to put it just on physical medical needs, that would be appropriate, but I guess from my discussions with Jeff Collins and from what I know from speaking with people at DOC, there are a point where some of these individuals will in fact not have that risk to the public, and but their health has not gone to the point of where that I think would be necessary under your suggestion. And so,
it was stated in the or. Of such advanced age or such debilitated medical condition. So they could make a determination that you're of a sufficient advanced age, we're just going to release you to a long-term care facility.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Who's going to pay for that?
I would hope that the released person would pay for it.
Well, how is that? If they just spent 30 years in prison, they don't have any, they're certainly not going to have the means to pay for long-term care. So, I mean, the cost is still there to the state, whether they're incarcerated in prison or whether in long-term care, and I suspect that long-term care could be significantly more expensive than being interned.
Well, see, those are issues that could be addressed at the time. We're not saying that they have to be released. We're saying that they may be released, and if they can make a determination that there's a cost-effective approach to take, they're allowed to do that, but they're not required to do that. I'm just throwing it out as an idea. Based on Representative Brzezinski's suggestion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I still think about the juveniles that will be tried as adults on rape one charges who comes back facing another charge, and they do 30 years, and so they're about 40 years old at the end of that. So actually, they're about 45, maybe close to 50 at the end of that 30-year time period. That person's not going to be... not going to fit the criteria that you're describing because they're going to be about 45 years old. So theoretically, they would need to be there for another 20 years before they would be eligible for release under your scenario.
If they go through this lengthy process of committing a serious offense and then committing another serious offense, we do have folks from the Sex Offender Supervision Network here. My concern is that, and I am looking at the clock, we start session at 10. We've had this brought back to us. We can correct the problem that brought it back to us. I'm certainly open to some clarification on the length of term, but whether or not we can accomplish that in the time permitted. This is the only work session I've been permitted on this bill, and I have to get written approval at this stage of the proceedings for any work sessions on any bills.
Mr. Chair, I understand the time thing. I guess I wanted everyone to see what's going to be coming as a minority report. I'm more than willing to put that there, and if we want to work on that and see if we can do something between now and it comes to the floor.
Let me suggest to you that you can offer this as a minority report, and we can all look at it and see if the minority report comes forward as something that's got a tenable limitation, and if not, because absent having some specific amendments in front of us, it's kind of hard to just adopt something. But let me understand this a little more clearly. For instance, the proposal could be a mandatory sentence of 30 years on the second conviction, but parole would not be granted after the 30 years unless the following conditions were met prior to review by the Board of Parole, and that's the listing that you have on the sheet here?
Yes, sir. Yeah, this, and the thing is, as I think more and more about this and looking at the type of facilities we have and what the needs are when you get people to a certain age, and some people, because of their tendency, even at an age 60, 70, whatever age that might be, could still have those tendencies, and those people should never be released. But we need to have the criteria in place for the ones at some point. I mean, it's just going to be astronomical. I've seen, I'm not sure which news story in another state.
I mean, I buy into what you're saying here as a concern, and I will tell you quite bluntly, if the Victims' Rights Amendments are adopted, you'd always have to go back to the judge to modify the sentence in the future, in my interpretation of it. Why don't we invite up Mr. Taylor from Corrections and Mr. Collins from the Sex Offender Supervision Network. Mr. Collins, you put together these suggestions. Were these ideas that came from the group then that works on these issues?
Yes, sir. For the record, Jeff Collins from the Sex Offender Supervision Network. The network met yesterday and the day before, and I asked the network to identify some criteria for possible parole, to give the board the flexibility for parole for this population, and we felt that these criteria were appropriate for these men. I think what the committee I'd like the committee to understand is that parole would not be mandated. They wouldn't have to be paroled, because if we're talking about those gentlemen that are dangerous, I haven't.
So you can make it a life sentence with a mandatory 30-year minimum and the possibility for parole subject to these conditions after the 30 years.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I called Jeff on this because I started thinking, what can we do, because there is that concern. And fortunately, they were meeting as a group, and so they ran everything across them. I mean, the bottom line is it's very similar to what we have with murder, where you get a life sentence, and at 25 years, you're eligible to go through the parole process. This here is going to, one, require 5 additional years, and two, it's not an automatic.
Mm-hmm. And I think the concept has merit. That's Mr. Taylor, what's the position of the Department of Corrections?
Department of Corrections hasn't, I was at the meeting yesterday with them when we got word this would be at 8 this morning, so I haven't had time to check with the department. I think we would be supportive of that change because of the population that we talked about before and how this grows. We also have some sense that in the next 30 years, when the first one of these folks would come out, we may have some technological or chemical changes, drug changes that might change the way we can manage and supervise people.
Well, colleagues, let me suggest this and ask. I'll lay out the proposition. First of all, we have the A. and Gross bill in front of us. We could adopt the A-10 amendments, which, first of all, restricts the scope of what's covered. Second of all, maintains the July 1, 2001 effective date. So we're back to what was the majority report. But secondly, if the committee was of a mind to adopt a conceptual amendment, we could say that change it to say life imprisonment, mandatory 30 years minimum. After the 30 years, parole may be considered if these conditions are met. And that's what you're proposing, gentlemen? Well, you're not proposing it for Corrections, I understand it. Mr. Collins, though, for the
Correct.
Group. And you're the folks who first came to this with the notion of how to restrict this in the first place. So, I mean, we need to understand this. The folks have been asking for this kind of approach that are suggesting this.
That's correct.
And that is a limitation on what the original bill was. It may not be as much of a limitation as people would want, but it's a limitation. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Collins, how do we know that the people that would be let out after the 30 years, how do we know that if they're in a nursing home that the workers are safe, if they haven't had any instances that you're supervising with those kind of people?
Representative Gianella, that is a problem. One consideration I have in the release plan would be nursing homes are very difficult for some of these men because they're either risky or the nursing homes will simply not accept them. So we have to find other housing for them, not nursing homes. And so we have elderly men coming out that we find very difficult to place. So what I'm asking is that before you're released, a family member, somebody has to provide some sort of, you know, secure residence that's not a motel under a subsidy that we now have, that we tend to place these men now.
So you do have some of this kind of secure housing set up already for some people?
For some, but unfortunately, we're told you're coming out, this is when you're coming out, and you better have it by then.
And this says you have to have the secure housing available before the parole is granted.
That's correct.
Let me run through this. I'm going to state a proposition. First of all, let's do this. We have the bill in front of us. I entertain a motion for the adoption of the A-10 amendments.
So moved.
All right. Representative Sinceri moves adoption of the A-10 amendments. Discussion on that. Is there an objection to adoption of the A-10 amendments? Seeing no objection, the A-10 amendments are adopted to A Engrossed House Bill 2605. Second of all, I would entertain a motion that would suspend the rules to allow consideration of conceptual amendments. That doesn't mean we're going to commit ourselves to them, but we allow consideration of conceptual amendments at this time. Is there such a motion?
So moved.
Representative Bowman moves that we suspend the rules to allow consideration of conceptual amendments to the bill. Is there any objection to the motion?
Objection.
All right, we have an objection. It would take a two-thirds vote to suspend the rules, as I recall.
The purpose of this is just to discuss.
Just to discuss. All right, we'll call a roll on the motion to suspend the rules. Call the reverse order, please.
Chair Manning?
Aye.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
Aye.
Representative Gianella?
Yes.
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Two-thirds. Yes. The motion is carried. So we've suspended the rules to allow consideration of conceptual amendments. Now, it is true. I've been hearing a lot about the question as to, with the life sentence in this kind of case, if we lock into a life sentence, what is the flexibility for the 75-year-old patient who at that point is considered either because of medical conditions enfeebled enough that they might be kept more cheaply, ironically enough, in another housing facility, or someone who's been in prison for so long and there's a full evaluation and housing is arranged where it's considered that at an advanced age they too would not be a threat to the community. It's really up to the committee as to whether or not they want to adopt that approach. I will state a proposition from what I've heard, Mr. Collins and Mr. Taylor, and you can interrupt me if I misstate this, and so can Representative Brzezinski. As a proposed conceptual amendment, and tell me, someone can move it and then we can debate it. The proposed conceptual amendment is to say that the life term, instead of being without the possibility of parole, is a life term with the possibility of parole after a 30-year minimum sentence. The 30-year minimum sentence is not subject to reduction. The parole application would have to be made and certain conditions would have to be met before parole can be granted, not to be carried out after parole can be granted. And the conditions that would have to be met are these, and I'm taking them, rephrasing what's on this form from the Sex Offender Supervision Network. First, there has to be a favorable psychosexual evaluation ordered and received by the board. Second, there has to be a favorable housing plan submitted that establishes a secure residence. This cannot be some kind of subsidy housing, as is sometimes arranged, but instead a secure residence. Third, there would have to be participation in and successful completion of available sex offender treatment programs while in prison, meaning that having already met all the conditions for having been incarcerated, there would again be a sex offender treatment program, participation and successful completion of that. Fourth, the parole board would be given the authority to revoke these offenders back to the Department of Corrections custody for the remaining portion of their sentences, that is, until they die, have that kind of revocation authority. as is paralleled with the murder sentencing that's allowed right now. Is that a correct statement of what you're proposing or suggesting, Mr. Collins?
That is correct.
All right. I would entertain a motion that such a conceptual amendment be adopted.
Mr. Chair, as much as I'd like to make that, this is something I would need to see.
All right. Friend,
because my concern is that we want to make sure it's done right, and I think that LC needs to have something on paper for us to review.
All right. All right, we won't have such a motion. Here's what I would suggest then. First of all, back in 1989, we would have done this. In 1991, we would have done this, but the rules have changed. And that's the way it is. And I was getting a signal from Mr. Horton that I was really pushing the envelope on conceptual amendments here, but it's also, I think, late in session. I suggest that in a moment we can send this bill out. A minority report can be developed, and in the minority report, if it's tight enough, might be something that is acceptable as an alternative. If it's not tight enough, then we have a basic bill that we sent out before. And that'll give everybody a chance to compare the two and see whether or not it's a tight enough alternative. So, having no motion on that, we're still in a work session. Representative Simmons.
I would be happy to make the motion.
All right.
To adopt the conceptual amendment that you stated.
And by the way, what could happen is once the conceptual amendment is adopted, it's processed by LC, I can certainly share this informally with committee members to make sure that the conceptual amendment language is accurate.
Mr. Chair, I mean, just for policy procedure, I will be objecting.
All right.
And I think that the rules are being circumvented.
I'm just trying to be helpful, Representative
Fazeski. I understand that, but the reality is I don't see us being here in the next. We're not getting out here in a week.
Okay.
If we're out here in a week, I'd say let's go for it.
But well, here's what we can do then. I appreciate your suggesting you could make the motion, Representative Simmons. There's an alternative here, too. We can send out this bill, and we can just establish this as law. In next session, there's time to come up with modifications because the law doesn't become effective till July 1, 2001. So that's another alternative to keep in mind. All right, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson.
Just one other conceptual thing to throw out. We've got the four things that are listed here. Would it be helpful if we had a fifth one that was something, in effect, for the convenience of the state if they no longer represent any public safety threat? Thinking in terms of somebody who maybe has been resistant of all sex treatment classes, treatment programs, but their physical health has deteriorated to the point that it'd be more cost effective to have them in some type of a health care facility than in prison.
I think it's a viable alternative, Representative Hanson. What I'd suggest is just at this point that we do have a couple of options. One is you can always present a minority report. Another is the next session. Since there is a delayed effective date, there'll be plenty of time to come in with refinements as to what to do on the life sentence. But we have an opportunity in front of us to establish that life sentence. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just for the record, I just want to say I would have a concern about the psychological evaluations. I've done a lot of work on those, and to hire someone who works for the parole board to give them an answer that they're looking for and then using that as a criteria for whether or not they get released is pretty suspect at best. And my experience with the psychological eval is it really doesn't matter to the parole board whether it's positive or negative. They make their decisions outside of that particular psychological evaluation. So just for the record, to create another process whereby they have to get a report that they're paying to get to give them an answer that's already, they've already concluded what that answer is, seems to be setting something else in statute that doesn't work well.
Okay. Well, Representative Cesari, do you move that we send the bill to the floor with a due pass with the A-10 amendments which have been added? Colleagues, you've heard that motion. Discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Fazansky.
The only concern I have is the same one I raised previously regarding the operative date. To me, it's passing the buck instead of dealing with the potential financial impact and such today. For the record.
All right. All right. You've heard the discussion. Is there further discussion? All right, the clerk will call the roll on the motion to send 2605 to the floor with a due pass as amended by the A-10 amendments.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Gunn-Sarie?
Aye.
Vice Chair Brazowski?
No.
Chairman?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill sent to the floor, due pass. I'm assigned myself as a carrier.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, possible minority report will be filed on House Bill 2605.
All right, noted. This closes the work session on House Bill 2605. We also have Senate Bill 345 in front of us. We'll move into work session, well, public hearing technically on Senate Bill 345. Is there anyone that wanted to testify? Probably nobody on the list.
You hang yourself, then.
All right. Is there anybody on the list?
Just for the record, it's blank.
All right, the list is blank. We'll go into work session on Senate Bill 345. Council, tell us where we are on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first I would mention for the committee, I do believe that Diane Middle did want to testify, and she may or may not be stuck in traffic.
But she likes the bill, and we're going to give her the bill.
She does. And there are...
Maybe. That's the signals I've read, but go ahead.
There are a couple of amendments that the committee has before it. I'll talk about the A6s first. What these do is to simply modify one portion of an existing statute which talks about the monthly distribution to the police standards and training account. And the current figure in there specifies that if that amount is not at least $390,630, then the Department of Revenue is to distribute from the reserved monies whatever amount will make up the shortage for each month. Diane Middle requested that that number be changed to $536,000 and indicated that she would give the background of why that number was appropriate at the time. I don't have any other information on that.
But that figure simply allows them, it gives them the protected amount that they need. It's updating the protected amount that they need to make sure they maintain the share that's needed for training, as I understand it, based on their latest budget. All right.
Mr. Chairman, the A5 amendments are also before the committee, and one of the potential uses of this bill, which does relate to public safety, was to take some of the quick, technical, non-controversial bills, House bills, that this committee passed out, and to insert them into this bill, not as a gut and stuff, but rather as an addition. And what the A5 amendments do is to take, unfortunately, we can only find two bills that the Senate had not already acted on that fell into this category, but House Bill 3047 and House Bill, I think the number is 3458, Section 9 under the A5 amendments is House Bill 3047, which was a clarification and a technical fix as to the classification of crimes and the length of time that could be served for some juveniles. And what Section 10 does is to simply direct the Judicial Department and Dispute Resolution Commission to review obstacles and opportunities for mediation of juvenile criminal matters. I suppose that should be juvenile delinquency matters.
These are both bills that passed the House by wide margins and, what, had unanimous committee support?
Yes.
And the idea was we're trying to help ease the burden for the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is telling us they have so many bills from us. We could simply amend these into this bill with these non-objectionable extra cars on the train, and then they could simply concur on the Senate floor. So...
Mr. Chair, I don't understand the Department of Revenue portion of this bill. Do they control the budget for the Police Standards and Training Division?
What happens is they receive funds, and there may be someone who wants to come up and explain that. Okay. The Department of Revenue distributes the funds from the unitary assessment. And this would guarantee that the necessary funds are available for the Board of Police Standards and whatever the BP, PST, I always have trouble with that long name.
Don't they have to make that case somewhere else rather than to us?
Well, the case is made, but from time to time, based on the expansion of those programs, the guaranteed amount to operate that operation is put into the statute. That's in case the unitary assessment's dropped. The other programs, the unitary assessments were started to fund this kind of program. And so there's always been a guarantee that some minimal amount is always available for the standards and training program. And it's unfortunate Diane Middle couldn't be here to explain and protect that amendment. Do you know anything else about it, Mr. Horton?
Representative Campbell's here.
Oh, Kevin Campbell's here. Perhaps he could help with this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I won't be able to help the committee with the technical nature of the amendment, but I can tell you that originally they intended, they found out about the necessity of this after the budget was sent out, and so they've been looking for a vehicle to put this into. As I understand it, it's a technical fix that protects the funding that actually goes to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and without it, the funding that they need evidently is not available. And so this is they have described it as a technical fix. They've been looking for a bill to put it in and could not do it in the budget, and so since it's already gone and signed by the governor. So I understand that it's got broad support. I understand it's important to the department and to the training fund. I can't answer the technical questions. So Representative Bowman, this is a trust me, but I'm not sure I know whether. That probably didn't work, did it?
It was close, very close.
Maybe I've guaranteed now I won't get any votes from the committee on that.
Well, I know I understand the picture. I mean, this figure has not been updated. We have a new appropriation with larger amounts. We have broader training programs provided, and the funding is there. But the statute has provided for some guaranteed amount so that they can contractually do their job and hire their people. Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Mr. Campbell can state this or not, but since you have some knowledge of the support, and it, because of the problem that I guess was occurred because it wasn't caught before the budget went through, do you know if the governor's or governor's staff is on board with this?
I believe the governor's staff is on board with the change.
Well, what we could do is rely on those representations in between the time this goes out and goes to the floor. If there's a problem, we can pull it back, too. And I am concerned only in the sense that we will probably only meet one or two more times, maybe three, depends on approval by the speaker, but we cannot assume that we'll have a chance to revisit any of these bills. All right, so we have those. Now, I have a note from Kathy Osborne that there is a problem with Section 9 in the A5 amendments. Could you come up and talk to us about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. The bill that you're trying to put into in Section 9, this is the original language, but then we had to add an amendment to add B and C misdemeanors because we had realized that we had left those out. So the bill was originally, the bill that came from this committee added B and C misdemeanors into this language. So the problem with just adopting this would be, again, we're leaving the B and C misdemeanors out.
Mr. Horton?
Ms. Osborne, if I could clarify, the Senate, however, has not had a hearing or work session on this bill, so there are no proposed amendments yet on the Senate side, correct?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Are you saying the bill has passed out by us had B and C misdemeanors?
Had B and C misdemeanors in it, yes.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
That's a suggestion that we could do because of the potential problem with the conceptual amendment, since it's longer than just one or three words. We could pass it out, and I assume that the chair could probably get some type of agreement from the Senate that this would go to a conference committee. We put in B and C, and then it's done.
Where was the language that you were talking about?
Section 9, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the bill number.
3047.
Yeah.
Can you get me a copy of
it? When we
can do that right now.
It was from the juvenile director's bill. And when we had the work session, we came up with this language, and then when it was...
So what LC has done is put in the original bill.
Put in the original language rather than the language that this committee amended by adding the B and C misdemeanors. That's correct.
Sigh. Well, that's why we have these work sessions. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. I'm sending out Mr. Horton to get that, to get the A and Gross bill, and I would not have a problem if we had the A and Gross bill in front of us checking that language in it. That, to me, is if we can't do that as a conceptual amendment, we might as well shut down if we decide to do it. Well, we do have the A and Gross 345, but I'm talking about the A and Gross 3047. Let's see what was done on that. What we'll do is we're going to recess on Senate Bill 345.
Let me ask one question.
Sure. Representative Brzezinski. And then
Larry Neisweiner is here.
Oh, good.
If the committee wants more comfort on that, that reserve fund, he...
That'd be great. Hi, Mr. Nicewinder, good morning.
Yes, Chair Mannix, committee members, for the record, Larry Nicewinder from Legislative Fiscal Office. The testimony that Chair Mannix provided you is I just wanted to confirm that. We passed out a budget for the department that requires a certain level of funding. This statutory amount has not been changed for several biennia. Its intent has always been to just ensure that the budget was adequately supported by unitary assessment revenues. This just acknowledges that, moves it up, doesn't change who gets, doesn't change the percentage allocation, doesn't hurt anybody, it just assures a base funding level for the department.
Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any other state department that gets statutory language to protect their base budget?
This one is the only one that I'm aware of, and it's because when this was set up, initially they were the primary recipient of those funds, and they are totally reliant on them. The other recipients are not agencies that are totally reliant on them. This is the only agency that virtually their entire budget is derived from that revenue source.
Problem with that. Representative Bowman, another
question? No, that was my question.
All right. Well, we do have the original amendments to 3047. Leanne Gross isn't here, but the amendments that we adopted are here. These are the dash one amendments, I believe. So now I'm looking at... Why don't I ask Council to take these back to Kathy Oswald? It looks to me like the dash one amendments are reflected in section 9 of this bill, but we'll hold on that for a moment because we do have the A6 amendments issue in front of us. On the A6 amendments, Representative Bowman, the idea of the original unitary assessment was to support this program. This department's total funding comes out of this. Over the years, as other people have decided they want to use the unitary assessment, it's been used as, it's been expanded, but each time the guarantee has been, well, okay, but this is assuming that we're going to have this amount of fines or assessments coming in, but we still need to guarantee that the agency that was set up based on that funding stream receives what we've budgeted for them. So far, that's never been a problem, but this provides the guaranteed base amount to go to that agency. If there's a shortfall in the unitary assessments, all the other participants proportionately get reduced, but this agency would have a guaranteed amount so that they don't have to lay people off. That's the idea behind the statutory scheme. And so that, and the reason for this amendment is to move up the base level to catch up with modern times, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, they're currently funding, I mean, they're currently providing training for other people other than strictly law enforcement officers. Do they charge for that? Is that also paid through this fund? Because, I mean, we've changed a lot since this fund was set up, and maybe it's time to look at whether or not that is, in fact, that should be the only game in town. My concern is putting it into statute and then assuming it's going to be there for a few years with all these changes that are taking place and all the additional training that this unit is now required to do. That just raises some questions for me.
Mr. Nicewinder,
yes,
can you respond to that?
Chair Mannix and Representative Bowman, those are concerns that were addressed in Ways and Means as well. This budget doesn't go as far as the committee wanted it to go in terms of implementing a 16-week basic police training course. Actually, they're only able to implement 10 weeks in this biennium, and it is because of revenue limitations along with some facility planning efforts that need to be concluded. In short, the subcommittee directed the agency to come back next session with a plan to get to that 16-week basic police training course, including a strategy for increasing revenue necessary to support that, and we're not there yet. And so it's not a case where the revenue is more than adequate or even excessive. It's actually inadequate at this point. And to address some of the revenue concerns you mentioned a minute ago in terms of their ability to charge for services, there is a bill that they believe this committee may have seen that does give them additional ability to charge certain people who are trying to go through training based on their ability to pay and self-sponsorship, and that will help, but it's not going to help them with some of the basic police training course revenue needs.
But the other question that Representative Bowman was asking, what about private sector folks who go through training or certification? Do they pay for that?
At this point, the programs that are there, private security is self-supported through the training program, the revenues that they generate. Others have to be state employees or county employees and correctional officers, parole
officers. So they're either public employees of one kind, which is the subsidy, or it's self-supporting on the private sector side.
That's correct.
Does that help, Representative Bowman?
It does. Representative Pazansky, last session, didn't we deal with the training issue of the number of weeks training? Didn't we expand that last session?
In theory, we did. In theory, we did. And we were trying to get that, but the thing is, it's one of those proposals that you just cannot have it up and running. They had to get the course curriculum together. They had to have the facilities, and it was supposed to be streamlined in. And then the other thing is the revenue to actually put on that type of structure. And that's what my understanding through our sub and ways and means, they're continuing to strive to get there. They just have not been able to reach the full 16 weeks.
Thank you. Appreciate the help.
All right. I'd entertain a motion that the A6 amendments be adopted. Representative Pazansky moves adoption of the A6 amendments. Is there discussion? Further discussion, I should say. Is there objection? Seeing none, the A6 amendments are adopted. Now, as to the A5, although the A5 do mirror the A engrossed House Bill 3047, Ms. Osborne raises a good point about the B and C misdemeanors. And we have these in front of us, and it's a simple language change because we know what the maximum time frame is. It's 6 months for a Class B misdemeanor and 30 days for... And I'll just express this as I understand it. And Ms. Osborne, please come on up and we'll make sure that I've got this clear. But that actually, if we wanted to completely cover this youth authority situation, where it says on line 13 of the A5 amendments, 1 year for an act that would constitute a Class A misdemeanor, we would... Where would we put this?
We put that prior to the 1 year because we put it in, it would be Class C misdemeanor if committed by an adult.
You're going to move CBA, I see.
And that'd be 30
It'd
days.
It'd be, all right, 30 days for an act that would constitute a Class C misdemeanor if committed by an adult, 6 months for an act that would constitute a Class B misdemeanor if committed by an adult, 1 year for an act that would constitute a Class A misdemeanor if committed by an adult. In other words, put both, all three of those levels in there.
Actually, I think what we were going to do, Sir Mannix, and for the record, this is Kathy Osborne for Juvenile Rights Project, was say 1 year for a Class A, B, or C misdemeanor. I just spoke to somebody from the Juvenile Directors, and he said that there actually are amendments over in the Senate that Mr. Taylor has. The reason that we were saying 1 year is because what we're talking about is the period of disposition, not the period of commitment or incarceration.
You could
so this
say
would
one
be
year
the period
that would constitute, you could just say a misdemeanor if committed by an adult, couldn't
right.
it?
So, because what we're talking about here is the period that a youth could be on, even on probation to juvenile court, and certainly the probation needs to be longer than the 30 days.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Dale Penn to come up because I think there's a statute that limits how long someone can be on probation. In line with the length of time that they can serve. I thought there was...
Mr. Penn, do you want to come on up? You've just been dragged in on
this. Sorry about this, but I want to make sure that we got it covered. I mean, 1 year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. Unfortunately, this is not an area I can give you good advice on, and rather than stumble into it, I'll just say I don't know.
I do know, Mr. Chair, that there are amendments that were drafted that were signed off on by everybody who was in the work group that was working on this, and I believe that that included somebody from Mr. Penn's office, at least, that are over on the Senate side.
Is the Senate going to go ahead and move on HB 3047 anyway?
My understanding is that they're working on getting it.
We just take it out of this
set for hearing.
Leave it for them to work on it then. All right, here's what we can do then. We have the A5 amendments in front of us. We could just move Section 10, which is HB 3458. What I'd do is this is really a technical change, not so much a conceptual amendment. We can just say we're going to adopt the amendment without the Section 9 and just do Section 10. That doesn't require a rephrasing by
But I'll first ask, is there any objection to this approach? And in fact, technically, I'll ask if there's any objection to suspension of the rules if this is considered a conceptual amendment. Seeing no objection, I would entertain a motion that we adopt the A5 amendment, but not use Section 9, include only Section 10. Representative Gianella?
Mr. Chairman, earlier I heard you say something about line 22 on the A5 amendments about changing the word criminal to delinquency.
Mr. Horton brought that up.
Mr. Horton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, that is a purely technical thing that was raised by Ingrid Swenson. Technically, juveniles engage in delinquency matters, not criminal matters. It wouldn't change the
meaning. That would be an appropriate conceptual amendment, technical amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Bowman moves that we adopt the A5 amendments with the deletion of Section 9. And in Section 10, on line 22, changing the word criminal to delinquency. So that's the motion in front of us. Discussion on that motion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. The A5 amendments as modified are added to the bill. I don't think we have any further amendments to consider.
Not that I know of, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman?
I move Senate Bill 345 as amended to the floor.
We just moved the A5.
Okay.
We just adopted the A5 with those changes.
Okay.
All right. The Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 345 as amended with the A5 amendments, which were modified per the earlier motion, to the floor with a due pass. This also includes the A6 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there an objection? Seeing none, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 345 is sent to the floor. Representative Simmons, would you carry this one?
Certainly.
All right, thank you. That concludes the work session on Senate Bill 345. Colleagues, we have one left. We'll move into work session on House Bill 3374. This bill was returned to us from the floor. Council, why don't you describe the situation we have in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, the A engrossed bill is before the committee, and the committee has the A19 amendments. What those do is to change the A engrossed bill as follows. First, the A19 amendments take out the provision which modified the length of the suspension or the removal of the hunting license for hunting cougars and bears in specified situations. There were some legal reasons for that raised by legislative counsel. The second thing that the A19 amendments do is to delete the section that gives federal officers the authority to arrest for a Class B or Class C misdemeanor if they have probable cause that the offense was not committed in their presence.
And then we just have a couple of technical corrections that flow with that.
Yes,
Representative Fazansky.
Again, I guess for the record for committee members, I went through this. Section 9 and Section 12 are coming out of the bill. And it was the bill stands. That's correct.
Yes.
Chair.
President Sinceri.
Part of my concern was that Section 9, I believe, violated the whole principle of federalism, and I'm glad to see that we're removing that. I still have a concern with Section 8, and I wonder if Mr. Penn could come up and just iterate for the record that, I think I discussed this with him once before, that below the Class A misdemeanor, can you explain our discussion on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Sinceri, Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. This is the measure that authorizes probable cause arrest authority when an offense, a B or C misdemeanor, occurs outside the presence of an officer. And what happens now, as I explained, I believe that this will facilitate the system working more smoothly, because what happens now is the officer is going to have to submit a warrant request, fill out an affidavit, present that paperwork to the district attorney's office. We're going to have to process that paperwork, submit it to the court, have a judge then review it, and then sign a warrant. And then after that warrant issues, then an arrest can occur. We have tremendous problems about because no one has been arrested or at any point been in the system, that warrant sits there for a long time. Sometimes the wrong people get arrested. It is a very bureaucratic and lengthy process. And the issue under the law is, does the officer have probable cause? And if there is probable cause, then it justifies the arrest. We did state that we felt that most of these would be handled as citations anyway. We didn't see this as a jail overcrowding situation, but it would greatly facilitate the process to allow that authority.
Mr. Chair, are there any violations that would pertain to guns or gun ownership here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanceri, I had that discussion with you also, that I did go back, and I can't say I made every page kind of list, but I went back and looked at particularly firearms offenses, and I could not find B and C misdemeanor firearm offenses that this would apply to. They are all A misdemeanors, or they are violations, and this does not give arrest authority for violations at all, only for B and C misdemeanor crimes.
So the expansion here of an authority of an officer would have nothing to do with firearms?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanceri, that's correct. I don't see that it would have any impact on the enforcement of firearms laws.
Representative Sanceri. Excuse me, Przanski.
I guess the only thing, I don't know if you're looking, I have not looked at it, but I thought there may be some hunting code violations that may fall within this group. Not the firearm per se.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, the fish and wildlife offenses, there could be some there. Those are already provided violation authority, and many times if someone has no record, they are handled as violations by officers. But I was looking at the firearms crimes themselves and the major criminal code.
Any further questions, Representative Sanceri?
I have no further questions, Mr. Chair, but I'm really concerned that we've got a bill here that deals with carry permits, and I am concerned that we may do something here that unintentionally expand the ability of officers to arrest, and that could affect.
If I could explain, what we're doing here is the relating clause on this bill was relating to crime. And it was a convenient vehicle for a couple of other changes in the statutes. And it was not intended that adding a Section 8 here had any particular reference to firearms laws. It referenced crime generally, and that was the intention there. And I heard the concerns on the floor from some members about federal officers' arrest authority, the increased arrest authority, so we're proposing to strip that out. And, of course, the impetus for the minority report was the Cougar issue, and although we have a letter from Legislative Council saying that a two-thirds vote is not required, that could be an argument. You'd end up having a lengthy argument about whether or not legally this bill had the necessary votes, and Representative Simmons kindly has agreed to see that provision stripped out of the bill, which I think would avoid a minority report, certainly would avoid the question of two-thirds. So we have the A-19 amendments in front of us, and those would strip out the what I'll call the Cougar provision, Section 12, and would also strip out the federal officer increased arrest authority provision, which is Section 9. Do I have a motion to adopt?
Mr. Chair, I wanted...
I did hear Representative Simmons say so moved, so
okay.
Representative Simmons has moved adoption of the A-19 amendments. Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we had this bill in front of us before, we debated about whether or not this actually changed passive resistance, the law surrounding passive resistance or civil disobedience.
I don't think that was in this bill, but I'm looking.
I think it was. Page 4.
Okay, we do have that passive resistance. That was language Representative Przanski brought in to clarify that provision.
Yes. So that was the good change.
I'd say that was the appropriate change.
Okay. Representative Bowman, that language is in here.
Okay.
And I stand corrected, that was covered by this bill.
All right. I'm fine now.
We have a motion to adopt the A-19 amendments. I discern that Representative Sanceri objects, or do you not?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't object to the 19s, but I want to proceed and try to fix Section 8 as well.
All right. Let's first deal then with the A-19 amendments. Further discussion on the A-19 amendments.
there any objection to adoption? Seeing no objection, the A-19 amendments are adopted in the bill. Representative Cesari, you wanted to discuss Section 8 further?
Right, I do, Mr. Chair, and I got a note here from Ms. Osborne. I think it would be appropriate to read it. That if the police can arrest, they can search, and so someone who is arrested for shoplifting can be searched, and if they have a gun, they now have additional problems. And I think that this expansion is...
That's true, but they can do that now. I mean, on a shoplifting, and if they're going to be arrested, they're going to put them through a process that's going to require them, and most agencies require them to go through a search and seizure or a pat-down for safety reasons. Or they're going to, if they're taken into actual custody and taken to a jail facility, there's going to be some type of inventory that's going to be taken, and they're going to have that problem anyway.
Well, Mr. Chair, if that's the case, then why is it necessary to have this language in the bill?
Well,
it's already, you can already do that.
Mr. Horton?
Well, first to clarify about shoplifting. Shoplifting can usually be either theft in the second degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor, and Representative Sinceri, you're right, they could already do that with a Class A misdemeanor to arrest, of course. It can also be a Class C misdemeanor, which is theft in the third degree. There is no Class B misdemeanor that applies. Now, normally what would happen currently for the Class C misdemeanor is that they could not be arrested for that unless it was committed in the officer's presence. They would be cited and let go, and except in extenuating circumstances, a search would not occur. Did that answer your question?
I believe it did. But I still...
I'm going to call up Mr. Penn's office for that, too. Go ahead, Representative Sinceri.
I'll wait for Mr. Penn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sinceri, Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. There are two different legal concepts that are involved here. Let's forget arrest for a moment. The court is going to examine, is there probable cause for arrest to justify a search, regardless if an arrest takes place. So the issue is going to be, is there probable cause for that arrest? What typically would happen in the shoplift situation is the officer can go ahead and effect an arrest if there's a citizen's arrest, a citizen signs the complaint. And so typically in shoplifting, what happens is the store clerk, who is the eyewitness and the complaining party, signs a citizen's arrest complaint, and that's why the arrest occurs in that scenario. This is really only going to apply for these other situations where it's not shoplifting, it's not these things. You have someone calls in about disorderly conduct or something else going on in a neighborhood. The police get there. They didn't see that. They're going to have to write it up as a written package and submit it for a warrant. That's really what this is going to impact.
If I may, we had this other bill, Senator Courtney brought this, about disorderly conduct in the schools, and I talked about how we've so weakened enforcement at the lower levels. They keep wanting us to shove everything up so that the officers can arrest, and if you have a serious fight on school grounds and somebody needs to be detained, it's disorderly conduct unless there was some true assault involved. It's a Class B misdemeanor, and that's why the schools were coming in saying, well, give us the school safety zone or whatever. This answers the question in part by saying, okay, it's a Class B misdemeanor, but if you've got three people here who are telling the officer, this guy just beat up on this other guy, the officer can make the decision, I've got probable cause to arrest and take this fighting student, or can decide it doesn't need to be done in the circumstances. But right now, the officer has to write up all the reports, go back to the courthouse, and run through the process Mr. Penn outlined before he can do anything. Usually, in the old-fashioned immediate intervention, actually just picking somebody up, you might decide, well, all right, we've picked them up, we've brought them in. Maybe after booking, maybe the people involved decide not to press charges and you drop charges. You've defused the situation.
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to suggest is that what we're doing in Section 8 under Sub B is we're eliminating Class A, and I think I would like to request that we restore that.
All right, so
that it's limited to Class A.
In effect, you wanted to delete Section 8 from the bill, which the whole thrust of that is to allow arrests for B and C misdemeanors not in the officer's presence. So Representative Sinceri moves that although we don't have a formal amendment in front of us, it's pretty clear what he wants to do, that we delete Section 8 from the bill. So we'll have discussion on that. With all due respect, I disagree with you on this point. I think that one of the biggest problems we have is a lack of immediate intervention in some of these situations where I think police can diffuse things. I also think in rural Oregon, this is a particular impediment to law enforcement. When some neighbor comes to the officer and says, less than so has committed this small-level crime, you know, some levels of trespass, for instance, are B and C misdemeanors, and the officer says, well, that's all well and good, but I didn't see it happen, so you know, next week when I get to the courthouse, I'll file a report, and I'll get a warrant, and I'll come back out and do something about it. And the guy says, wait a minute, officer, this guy's been doing this every day. He keeps trespassing on my property, and you're not doing anything about it. Well, I'm sorry, but you know, I've got to get to the county seat. I've got to talk to the DA. I've got to get the warrant and come back. I think that deters effective immediate law enforcement, particularly in rural Oregon. And most states do not have this kind of restriction. This is something that was new in Oregon in the last 20 years, maybe now it's 30 years. I'm not sure if it came in the 70s or the 80s, but it's proved to be, in my view, an impediment. And I'll just shut up at that point and hear from other members of the committee on that.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I had concerns with that piece from when we initially had this bill in front of us, only because we already know that we don't prosecute anything that low, and we did. They definitely don't go to court. So I think I supported this bill when it was here before. I held my nose and supported it. But I would definitely support Representative Sansanci's motion to take that out.
Mr. Chair.
I'm from rural Oregon, and I support deleting Section 8 of this bill.
Deleting or needing?
I mean, deleting. She said deleting.
Oh, no, but
I just deleted it in, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen? Representative Pazansky, what are you? All right, well, we've heard the motion. Representative Sinceri has moved that we delete Section 8 from the bill. We'll take a vote on that, and I'm assuming that we'll just take the vote. We'll just move forward on that to delete Section 8 from the bill.
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Timmons?
No.
Representative
Sinceri? Yes.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
No.
Chair Mannix?
No. The motion is defeated. We have the bill in front of us. Are there any further amendments to be offered? Representative Brzezinski, do you move the bill to the floor to pass?
As amended.
As amended?
Yes.
All right. Representative Brzezinski moves the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion on the bill? All right. Will the clerk call the roll, please, on the motion?
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sunferry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
Aye.
Chair Mannix?
Aye. Motion is carried. House Bill 3374 is sent to the floor with the due pass. I'm going to go ahead and assign this to myself and Representative Brzezinski as a backup if I'm not available as a carrier on this. And any other business come in front of the committee today?
You sure you want to carry that bill, Mr. Chair?
Oh. That sounds like a portent of doom. Actually, we'll assign that to Representative Brzezinski. I'll be the backup carrier if there's any problem. And this concludes the work session on House Bill 3374, and we are adjourned. Could I speak briefly to a couple of about stuff? June 15th. I don't know.